The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Everyone, this is Brad McDonald. I'll be your host for today's program. It's nice to be back in the hot seat. It's been a few weeks, I think, since I hosted a Trumpet Daily. Stephen is on his way back to Bonnie, England, and he'll be back with you tomorrow or the next day, I guess. Well, on this program and at thetrumpet.com, we've been breaking down Brexit over the past week. We've been exploring Brexit from all sorts of different angles, and today I'd like to talk a little more about that subject, but to begin with, I'd like to explore what is a global trend, and this trend is absolutely evident within this issue of Brexit. And I'm talking about the failure of leadership and the corresponding disenfranchisement that's happening all around this world, right, all around the world right now. Leaders are failing their people. Leaders are failing their institutions. Leaders are failing their governments. And populations across the earth, from Africa to South America, to the United States, to Britain, to Europe, publics across the earth are losing trust. They're losing hope and faith in their leaders. I mean, I don't have a deep enough understanding on history to be absolutely certain about this statement, but it seems to me that the dissatisfaction with our leaders is unprecedented. There's a lot of articles right now just talking about whether, and it doesn't matter what country you go to, America, Britain, Europe, wherever you go, there are chasms between rich people and poor people and the elites and regular people. And wherever you go across this world, people are upset with their leaders, and there's no faith that the leaders can fix the problems that all the different countries around this world face. I mean, here are just a few facts to bring home this point. You've probably heard a lot of these. But in America right now, only 16% of Americans approve of the way Congress is doing its job. Only 16% of Americans approve of the way the government, Congress at least, is doing its job. That was from a Gallup poll taken in June. Many have made this point in relation to the election that's coming up later this year. A lot of people have said, you know, it's a choice between two horrible options. It's a choice between two deeply flawed and generally unpopular candidates. I mean, Hillary Clinton has supporters who love her, but for the most part, people, they don't like her, or if, you know, they don't have an opinion one way or another. It's the same with Donald Trump. You know, not one of these candidates has a large majority or even a significant majority of the American public really excited about America being turned around, really filled with hope about the opportunities in America's future. I mean, we're looking at a presidential campaign, or we're looking at an election between, you know, an alleged criminal or a criminal and a reality TV celebrity. The quality of leadership is just not that impressive. And then in the Senate and Congress, well, only 16% of Americans actually are satisfied with the way they're doing their job. Here in Britain, it's not much better. One poll earlier this year showed that 35% of Britons were satisfied with the way the government was running the nation. Only 42% were satisfied with the way Prime Minister Cameron was doing his job. This is back in January. 31% were satisfied with the way Jeremy Corbyn, the leader of the Labour Party here in the UK, was doing his job. Now, I mean, you think about what's happened over the past week. Britain's Prime Minister has resigned. The Conservative Party now is just locked in a battle over who's going to lead the party, who is the next Prime Minister going to be. And then the Labour Party is just eating itself alive. 75% of Labour Party lawmakers recently voted and requested that Jeremy Corbyn resign. There's a massive leadership crisis. We heard in the news at the top of the hour about Australia's national election. There's still no result. It's incredibly close, and somehow I don't understand how this happens, but somehow we're not going to have a result for another week or two. But there's a good chance that Australia is going to have a hung parliament. There's not going to be a clear winner. And you can find similar statistics for pretty much every country around the world. There is a crisis of leadership in this world, and especially in America and Britain and Australia. Peggy Noonan captured this or wrote about this trend nicely in the Wall Street Journal last Friday, and I thought I'd just read a few segments from this article by Peggy Noonan. The title is "A World in Crisis and No Genius in Sight." An old order is being swept away, she writes, and political leaders everywhere seem lost. The leaders of the world aren't a very impressive group right now. There's a sense with some of them of playing out a historical or cultural string that they're placeholders in some way. Many are young, yet so much around them feels tired. And then she says, which has me thinking again of the concept of the genius cluster. And this is just a really interesting observation that she makes, and this is not original with Peggy Noonan, but this concept of a genius cluster says that there's it's about, you know, looking at history and just seeing the emergence on the world scene from time to time of a group of high quality leaders that converge for a few years, usually during a type of crisis, really achieve or accomplish some phenomenal acts. And then they're gone. She invokes the history of America's forefathers. Somehow Franklin, Jefferson, Washington, Adams, Madison, Hamilton, Jay, and Monroe came together in the same place at the same time and invented something new in history of man. And, I mean, if you think about that, it really is just fascinating, isn't it? How we had the emergence right around the same time of 6 or 7 just absolutely outstanding thinkers, men of high quality. And they built America. They built a modern America. They came together and, you know, they negotiated the split with the United Kingdom, and they figured out, you know, the Declaration of Independence and America's Constitution, and then they were gone. There was this genius cluster. She asked, Peggy Noonan talks about how she was talking about this with a historian one day. And she asked him, how does this happen? You know, how are there genius clusters? And he thought about it, and he said, providence, I guess. He didn't have a good explanation. She writes, there was a small genius cluster in World War II. Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Churchill, Charles de Gaulle. Then the military genius cluster of World War II. Marshall, Eisenhower, Bradley, Montgomery, Patton, MacArthur. Almost rivaled that of the Civil War. Grant, Lee, Stonewall, Sherman, Sheridan, Longstreet. But if you look back on history, during times of crisis, and it's, you could do the same thing with British history if you go back to Gladwell and some of those guys in the 19th century, there would be this cluster of outstanding leaders that would almost suddenly emerge, and they would lead the country through the crisis and then lay a foundation for stability and growth. Noonan continues, obviously, genius clusters require deep crises. Otherwise, their gifts are not revealed. Historic figures need historic circumstances. Also, members of genius clusters tend to pursue shared goals. We have those conditions now. The crises and what should be shared goals. Everything feels upended, she writes. The old order that has governed things for 70 years since World War II is being swept away. Borders have disappeared before our eyes. Terrorism, waves of immigration transforming whole nations. Islam at war with itself and parts of it at war with the world. In the West, the epochal end of public faith in institutions and a dreadful new tension between the leaders and the led. In both background and foreground is a technological revolution that has actually changed how people experience life. It is a world crying out for bigness, wisdom, steady hands, and steady eyes. We could use a genius cluster, but I'm not seeing its members coming. Are you? It's just a great article from Peggy Noonan. Not since World War II has there been a greater need for some genius leaders in this world, and we could break it down in the United States, in Britain, but they're not there, and there's no signs that they're coming. There's no new up and comers. There's no young Ben Franklin's running around, George Washington's. There really is a leadership crisis. Of course, if you've been following the trumpet, this will remind you of a prophecy that we've discussed and explained for many, many years, and that is the prophecy over in Isaiah chapter 3. We discuss this prophecy so often that sometimes it's easy to for it to become maybe like a like a pop song, or you just don't think too much about the words or the meaning. It's just something that we're so familiar with. But I just wanted to go through some of these scriptures in Isaiah 3 and just show how incredibly prescient they are. This is not just kind of a general prophecy. It's not just a general summary or description of the way the situation is in Britain and America today. When you compare the language in Isaiah 3 with conditions as they are today, it's remarkable how accurate the Bible is. The Bible absolutely nails it. And it nailed it 2,500 years ago. That's what's really remarkable. And then that fact should really lead us into some bigger questions. Well, wow, how did the Bible forecast this 2,500 years ago? How was it so specific? How does that happen? And that leads you to the question, well, the only rational explanation is that there was a power that inspired this book, and then there was a higher power that brought these things to fruition. But let's just look at this prophecy here, and it's talking about the nations of Israel. It's talking about end time Britain and America specifically. And verse 1 says, God says, "For behold, the Lord of hosts, does take away from Jerusalem and from Judah." Jerusalem is a type of Ephraim and Manasseh, or Britain and America, Israel, the birthright nations. God takes away from Jerusalem and from Judah talking about the actual nation of Israel today, the state of Israel, from Judah, the stay and the staff, and the whole stay of bread and the whole stay of water. I'll just read the next few verses from the Fenton translation. Look at what God is taking away from the nations of Israel. God takes away the general, the man for war. He takes away the great military leaders. He takes away the judge and the prophet. He takes away the consulter and chief. God takes away the captain who holds command. I mean, you just go back and look at, there's so many articles out there right now talking about how America's military, and particularly America's leadership, military leadership, is just being gutted. Generals are resigning all over the place. There's competition between leaders. There's a massive loss of faith in the White House and the leadership that's coming from the federal government. The captains are being taken away. God takes away the advisor. God takes away the skilled engineer, it says in the Fenton. That's talking about the artisans. It's talking about those who perform skilled labor. I mean, you can look at that and see that trend unfolding in America and Britain and really in many places in the first world for 10, 20, 30 years. I mean, as in the Brexit debate, a lot of people talked about how, well, Britain doesn't have any skilled artisans anymore. It doesn't have any skilled engineers, to use the term Fenton uses. It doesn't have any more, you know, it has fewer and fewer tradesmen, people who can do skilled labor. Everybody wants to tweet and do social media and be bankers. And we don't have any road builders and tilers and painters and decorators. And so the Polish come in and all of these, we get a lot of immigrants coming in filling those positions. It's because the skilled engineer has been taken away. God takes away, the Fenton says, the contriver of plans. And I let boys be their leaders and children to rule, and the people distracted by man against man, and each by his neighbor oppressed, the young by the old, and the low by the high. God takes away the genius clusters. There will be no genius cluster in the end time. Providence was responsible for the genius cluster that surrounded, you know, America's revolution, for the genius cluster that came together during World War II, for the genius cluster that came together during World War I. But God has now taken away their geniuses. There will be no genius cluster. But, I mean, we could just, for a couple of minutes here, let's go through and just break down some of these terms. When it talks about, you know, God takes away the advisor and the contriver of plans. God takes away the diplomat and the statesman. I mean, do you think Britain right now needs some top quality diplomats and negotiators? Someone was saying here at the lunch table the other day, Chris Eames was telling me how New Zealand has offered to send over their negotiators to help Britain negotiate its way out of the EU, because Britain doesn't have any negotiators, or it doesn't have enough people, enough experts to negotiate this separation. I mean, nothing against New Zealand, but they're a long way away. It's a different culture. I mean, they don't have the history with working with the European mind. There's probably a lot of nuances in these conversations that you know, someone from New Zealand or Australia or America probably isn't going to understand. But Britain doesn't have enough, so we may have to import some of our diplomats and negotiators. God says that he lets boys be their leaders. I mean, doesn't it feel like that sometimes, that we're led by a bunch of boys? God says that he lets children to rule. Again, doesn't it feel like we're led by children? I mean, when you watch the president, the presidential campaign in America, and I mean, it looks like two children fighting and bickering. It's worse, actually. It's interesting. The Fenton translation says that you know, Israel or the people are distracted, man against man. Our national leaders and the public is so busy fighting one another, trying to get ahead, trying to further their policies, that they're distracted from the larger issues. Each by his neighbor is oppressed. There's division and hostility between the different facets of society. I mean, if you go online right now, you're going to see so many articles talking about the disenfranchisement setting in populations against the leadership. You're going to see so many articles talking about the, you know, the 1%ers and the 99%ers, and so many articles talking about you know, the haves and the have-nots. I mean, all these different facets of society are rivaling against one another. Rich versus poor, elites versus non-elites. There's the nationalists versus the worlders. That's a term I coined the worlders. That's a term to kind of, it means this group of people who tend to place international interests. They tend to place participating in the global community ahead of the national interest of their own country. I mean, those two groups have really emerged in this Brexit debate. You know, a lot of nationalists voted for Britain to leave Europe or leave the EU. Worlders voted for Britain to remain. There is no Britain, they say. We're all part of this European community. We're all European. That's what it means to be tolerant and multicultural. But our society is, I mean, we're oppressing one another. The young by the old, the Bible says, and vice versa. The low by the high. I mean, it's right here in Isaiah 3. God says that the low and the high, there'll be oppression. The wealthy, he's talking about the wealthy versus the poor, which is just so evident. The tension, the animosity, the frustration between the rich versus the poor. It's evident. People are writing about it. Well, the prophet Isaiah wrote about it 2,500 years ago, and he wrote about it in direct relation to Britain and America. It really is. I mean, is there as I read Peggy Noonan's article and her lament for the lack of genius clusters, I couldn't help but just think and marvel at Isaiah 3 and how accurate that prophecy is and how brilliant God is to be able to make forecasts like that and to bring them to fruition. Okay, we'll go ahead now and take a short break. After the break, we're going to come back and we are going to explore Brexit.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Perhaps no hour in Britain's history was darker than that preceding World War II. Nazi Germany was arming. Nations in Europe were being conquered, their borders redrawn. Britain, the nation that once ruled one quarter of the earth, teetered on the edge of survival. Many leaders in Britain feared war. They wanted to disarm. They spoke of peace as Europe sank deeper into the pit of war. This dark hour may have been Britain's last, were it not for one man. This man stood alone in the face of adversity at home and abroad. He rose to the occasion when his nation needed him most. He vowed that Britain would never surrender when confronted by forces of evil. Winston Churchill took Britain's most important job during Britain's darkest hour. He did what others were afraid to do. Some doubted his methods, but the results speak for themselves. Churchill led Britain from the precipice of ignominious defeat and possible death to what became one of the nation's brightest hours. What was it that made Winston Churchill so different from other leaders of his time? Surely now, more than ever, this world needs another Winston Churchill. Our booklet, Winston S. Churchill, The Watchman, explains what made this man such a great leader. We would like to offer this booklet to you free of charge. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily.
Welcome back. I'm Brad McDonald, and I'm taking the program today for Stephen Flurry. In this segment, we're going to explore Brexit, but I'd like to focus on some prophecies about Brexit. I understand Mr. Flurry has been doing this the past week or so, but there's a lot of prophecies that talk about end time events in Britain at this time right now. One book of the Bible that has really leapt into focus over the past week has been the book of Hosea. The book of Hosea covers a lot of end time prophecy about Israel, about the nations of America and Britain. But Hosea, more than any of the other prophets, focuses on Ephraim or Britain and events in this country in the end time. And as I mentioned, this book has really come into focus with Brexit. And this book, the book of Hosea, is going to come more into focus in the coming weeks and months. And hopefully I can show you that today by just going through some specific prophecies and observations that God makes about Ephraim or Britain here in the end time. Now, if you want to study some of these prophecies for yourself, you can by requesting Mr. Gerald Flurry's book, Hosea, Reaping the Whirlwind. The title is Hosea, Reaping the Whirlwind. And you can request that book free by visiting thetrumpet.com. But let's just study a few of these prophecies. I'm going to turn to Hosea 5. You're probably making a cup of coffee or taking a shower. You probably don't have a Bible in front of you. But you can take my word for it that I'm reading it correctly. Hosea 5, and we can just start in verse 9. I'm just going to hit three or four passages in Hosea that talk about Ephraim specifically. There are more, lots more. But Hosea 5, verse 9 says, Ephraim shall be desolate in the day of rebuke. Among the tribes of Israel have I made known that which shall surely be. And really, the book of Hosea, or a big chunk of the book of Hosea, is about Ephraim's desolation in the day of rebuke. Ephraim's desolation is a theme of this entire book. There's one or two other significant, even very important themes as well. Verse 11 says, Ephraim is oppressed and broken in judgment because he willingly walked after the commandment. Oppressed means Ephraim is defrauded, it's violated, it's deceived. Judgment means verdict, or a verdict pronounced judicially. Commandment means an injunction or a precept to enjoin, to constitute. The language here is, there's a lot of legal terms. But there's no clarity of vision in Ephraim in the end time. There's no judgment. There's no wisdom in Ephraim. I'll read some articles to you in a few minutes that really prove that powerfully. But it's interesting to think about this verse in the context of Britain's membership in the EU since 1974. More than 50% of the laws in the UK were made in Brussels by EU leaders. Britain, all these decades, has subjected itself to the leadership and government of a foreign entity. What does that reveal about Britain's judgment? Verse 11 in the Fenton translation says, Ephraim is broken and crushed by defeat because he has consented to follow lies. That's another terrific summary of Britain's membership in the EU all of these decades. It's broken, it's crushed in defeat because for years and years and years it subjected itself to the European Union. Now, of course, that's not the only reason Ephraim is broken and crushed, but it's a big part of it. Britain, in the end time, it's violated, it's deceived, it's taken advantage of by other nations. Why? Because it enjoins itself to others. It consents to follow the lies of others. And if you study the book of Hosea, it's evident that this really is one of Ephraim's chief sins. Britain embraces foreigners. It embraces people of other cultures and languages and religions, even to the point of rejecting its own culture, its own institutions, its own history, its own religion. It's not about not appreciating other cultures. That's not what the Bible's talking about. That's not what God says. But Britain embraces foreigners and their ways, and it forgets about its own ways, its own history with God. Verse 12 says, therefore will I be unto Ephraim as a moth, and to the house of Judah as rottenness. Here, God compares end time Britain with a moth-eaten garment. Have you ever gone to your drawer and dug out a shirt that you assumed was ready to be worn, and you go to put it on, and then you realize that it's full of holes. It's been devoured by moths. That's Britain. That's Britain. And in many ways, Brexit is exposing how many holes there are in Britain. And the next few weeks and months will expose how flawed, how damaged Britain is as it tries to come together and figure out how to leave the EU. Britain is like a moth-eaten garment. It may look good on the outside. It may look like everything's okay. but it's full of holes. And when the time comes to act, when the time comes to put the shirt on, Britain will realize we just don't have it. We just can't do it. We're not healthy enough. There's too many problems. Just a few scriptures in Hosea 7. This whole chapter really is pretty phenomenal, and it's aimed right at end time Britain. Verse 1, when I would have healed Israel, God says, then, so God, you know, God wants to heal Israel. He doesn't take pleasure in the suffering. When I would have healed Israel, then the iniquity of Ephraim was discovered, and the wickedness of Samaria, for they commit falsehood, and the thief cometh in, and the troop of robbers spoileth without. Falsehood, you know, means lies and deceit and trickery. Ephraim is full of lies and deceit and trickery. There's a massive moral decline and moral depravity. It's a nation laden with corruption and lies. And the thief cometh in. Ephraim is being destroyed from within. It's being destroyed, and it's going to be increasingly undermined and dismantled by enemies operating stealthily from inside the nation. Clark's commentary says about that term there, that their own princes spoil them. Their own princes spoil them. So there's a big leadership problem here. Britain's leaders damage the country. How? Well, part of it was by taking them into the European Union. And then it says, robbers spoileth without. So there's also threat of foreign invasion, war from outside the country. And this, as is also evident throughout the book of Hosea, is inflicted by the Assyrians, or Germany in this end time. Clark's commentary says, the Assyrians, under different leaders, waste and plunder the country, or Ephraim. Verse 2, and talking about Ephraim, they consider not in their hearts that I remember all their wickedness. Now their doings have beset them about. They are before my face. See, Ephraim rejects God. It rebels against his warnings. There's no room for God and what he has to say. They don't realize that God is watching their evil and their wickedness. Ephraim is just full of arrogance and vanity. There's a real, we can do this on our own attitude. And they forget that God sees everything. Verse 3, they make the king glad with their wickedness, and the princes with their lies. The monarchy and the leaders of Ephraim do nothing to curb Ephraim's sins, its moral slide. They actually lead the way. Verse 4, they are all adulterers, as an oven heated by the baker, who ceaseth from raising after he had kneaded the dough, until it be leavened. In the day of our king, the princes have made him sick with bottles of wine. He stretched out his hand with scorners. For they have made ready their heart like an oven, while they lie in wait. The baker sleeps all night. In the morning it burns as a flaming fire. They are all as hot as an oven, and have devoured their judges. All their kings are fallen. There is none among them that calls unto me. So Ephraim's sins burn like a raging oven, God says. It's as if the baker has walked away and he's forgotten that the oven has been left on, and it just gets hotter and hotter and hotter. This is what Mr. Flurry wrote in Hosea, Reaping the Whirlwind. He says, the phrase hot as an oven refers to Britain's corruption. There is no true justice left in the land. Britain may look good on the surface, but God says in verse 8 that it is like a cake not turned, already burned out underneath. British society lacks any real substance. We are, even now, witnessing this great calamity in Britain, the United States, and other Israelitish nations. Serious crises are going to make our nations crumble suddenly like a burned out cake. It will dumbfound the world, just as the rising of the United States of Europe will astound the world. And aren't we entering that scenario now, where Britain is about to crumble like a burnt piece of cake, while a United States of Europe rises to astound the world? Verse 8 of Hosea 7, again, just consider how accurate, how absolutely spot on these prophecies are in their description of Britain. Verse 8, Ephraim, he has mixed himself among the people. Ephraim is a cake not turned. Strangers have devoured his strength, and he knows it not. Yes, grey hairs are here and there upon him, yet he knoweth not. This exact scenario is evident right now in Britain. This is a prophecy that Britain in the end time would intertwine itself with foreign people, foreign customs, foreign religions, foreign entities, like the European Union. Britain mixes itself among the people. This is one of Ephraim's chief sins. Multiculturalism is one of Ephraim's chief sins. Again, this is not the Bible attacking other cultures. And this is not a biblical license to be racist. It's not a biblical endorsement of racist attacks, some of which have occurred since Brexit. The Bible's not endorsing that. What the Bible is saying is that Britain has forgotten itself. It's forgotten its relationship with God. It's forgotten its own impressive history and culture and relationship with God. And it's just giving itself over to others. I mean, in essence, what God is saying is, Ephraim has forgotten me and everything I taught them and the relationship I've had with them going all the way back to Abraham. And they've fallen in love with foreigners. They've mixed themselves among the people. Verse 10, and the pride of Israel testifies to his face, and they do not return to the Lord their God, nor seek him for all this. You see, no matter, well, things are going to get worse and worse and worse. But as they get worse and worse, Britain, it doesn't turn around and repent. It doesn't say, oh boy, something is wrong. They just continue plowing forward in their rebellion. There's a lot of talk among leavers right now, those who want to leave the European Union. And they say that, you know, Nigel Farage and some of the others, they say that, you know, the time has arrived for Britain to go out on its own, to reclaim sovereignty and to resurrect the great British lion. Well, Hosea compares Britain and its personality and behavior in this end time to an animal that doesn't resemble a lion at all. Look at what that animal is in verse 11. This is what God says Britain is like in the end time. Ephraim has become like a dove, without heart in her fears. To Egypt they cry, and to Assyria they go. Britain is like a weak, pathetic little dove, fluttering naively in a park full of predators. That's Britain. And they, like a dove, like a silly dove, they go calling to Germany and calling to Europe to be their partner, to save them. And that's something to remember. You know, Britain has just voted to leave the European Union. But there is still, even among leavers, including Nigel Farage, they all still believe that Britain needs to be close to Europe. They believe that Britain needs to be close to Germany, have good relations with Germany. I mean, you can see that from a pragmatic standpoint, and it does make sense, I guess, from a geopolitical standpoint. But for too many people, there's not a reticence. There's not enough hesitancy to get into bed with Germany or the European Union. I just want to read some quotes from an article by Boris Johnson. He was one of the, if him and Nigel Farage were probably the two most prominent voices campaigning for Brexit. Boris Johnson is a leading figure in the Conservative Party, very, very influential, and up until a few days ago, a leading candidate to become Britain's next Prime Minister. Here's what he wrote about Germany a couple of years ago, and listen to this and ask yourself if there is a better comparison to that of a silly dove. Forget about trying to contain Germany. We should copy it. That's the title of his article. And he says, well, I think it's all... He went to visit... He took his children and his family to Berlin. And then he was inspired to write this article. Well, I think it's all perfectly wunderbar. Before me on the yellow gingham tablecloth, I can see a foot-high glass of cold lager and nestling beneath it a succulent place of sausage and kartoffel, all very reasonably priced. And then he talks about how beautiful and wonderful Berlin is. And then he invokes the history of his grandfathers. They both fought for the Germans, you see, and I don't think they would much mind me mentioning it now. In both their cases, their experience was pretty awful. And then he says he recalls what his grandfather used to tell him. Whatever we do, he used to tell me, we must stop the Germans reuniting. Granddad wanted to keep Germany divided in two manageable chunks, east and west. Then he says, two days after unification, we have taken advantage of cheap air travel to show the kids the capital of United Germany, the heart of what is by far the most important economic power in Europe. And I have to say that my learned grandfather has been proved wrong. Everything tells me that his anxieties were baseless and that the reunification of Germany has been one of the greatest success stories of modern geopolitics. So everything, all the concerns his grandfather's had about a united Germany, about Germany gaining too much control, it's all baseless, says Boris Johnson. Really? I mean, aren't the horrors of two world wars legitimate justification for a little bit of skepticism over allowing Germany to reunite and allowing Germany to gain too much power in Europe? I look around modern Berlin and I don't see Prussian revanchism. I see not the slightest sign of German militarism. And he goes on and talks about what he sees. You look at Berliners today, Boris Johnson says, and you ask yourself what the fuss was about 24 years ago. There were people like my grandfather and Margaret Thatcher who were instinctively hostile to German unification because they remembered what Berlin had done in two world wars. Then there were the Euro-Federalists who argued that Germany needed to be locked in to Europe, that we needed a single currency to contain Europe. What a load of bunk that turned out to be. This is the sentiment now. This is the spirit leading Britain. I mean, there's a lot of people thinking and talking like that, just like that. During the 1930s, Britain's Prince of Wales travelled to Hitler's Germany and admired what Hitler was doing over there. Boris Johnson continues, we don't need to lock in Germany with a single currency or indeed any other Federalist fiction. And then he concludes, I can understand why my grandfather's generation felt as it did, but it is emphatically time to forget all that and embrace the new Germany. We have much to learn and to understand. We have absolutely nothing to fear. Based on what, Mr. Johnson? One day riding your bike around Berlin? One day riding your bike around Berlin, and you can say, or we can conclude, that we've got nothing to fear from Germany? I mean, I go to Germany regularly. I love Germany. I love the stability. I love the laws. I love the people. I love the culture. Some of the greatest artists ever have come from Germany. It's a wonderful nation. But we can't forget the national character of the German people. We can't forget two world wars. We can't forget the 19th century and Bismarck. We can't forget Otto the Great in the 11th century. We can't just wipe out of all this history and just forget about it. And just say, we have absolutely nothing to fear? I mean, isn't the foolish dove description just absolutely spot on? Now, I read Boris Johnson's article because that is the sentiment, or that sentiment, that attitude, that approach to Germany is very, very prominent right now here in Britain. I have quite a few articles. I'm not going to get to any of them. One article from The Spectator: let's leave the EU and join Germany. In fact, the author says, in fact, isn't there only one country in Europe with which we want to be BFFs, best friends forever? You know the one I'm talking about, the Big G. Not only are we temperamentally similar to our German friends, we also have more in common with them than we do our neighbours, the French, or even our cousins, the Americans. And then he goes on and he describes all the ways that Britain and Germans are similar, and how Britain needs to join Germany now and go to Germany to help us come out of the EU. Another article: why Germany will ensure a painless Brexit. And there's a real, if you've read been watching the news the past couple of days, inside Europe right now, there's a lot of animosity boiling over, a lot of animosity for Brussels and for Brussels leaders, Schultz and I forget the other fellow, Juncker. And more people are saying, boy, we need to forget about Brussels and we just need Angela Merkel and Germany to lead us through the next few weeks and months. There is enormous dislike of Brussels and EU leaders. There's a tidal wave of animosity building in Europe and in here in Britain. And right now, the growing preference is for Germany to lead Britain out, or to help Britain negotiate its way out of the EU. Now let's just conclude with a prophecy over in Hosea 5:13. Again, this too was prophesied in the book of Hosea. Hosea 5:13, and Mr. Flurry has been talking about this prophecy for 15 to 16 years. We read up to verse 12 earlier, therefore will I be unto Ephraim as a moth. Verse 13 says, when Ephraim saw his sickness and Judah saw his wound, then went Ephraim to the Assyrian and sent to King Jareb, yet could he not heal you nor cure you of your wound. So here we have Ephraim and Judah, the nation of Israel, and they go to Assyria, or they go to Germany for help. Ephraim is sick, it says there in verse 13. Ephraim is weak. Ephraim is ailing. It's a fluttering, wounded dove surrounded by predators. And they go to Assyria. And that's happening even now. You can see it in the headlines of these articles. We need Germany to help us now leave the EU. Post-Brexit Britain is positioning itself to become closer and ever more reliant on Germany. I'll just read a quote from a sermon that Mr. Flurry gave on April 17th, 1998. And he's talking about Hosea 5:13. But you notice in verse 13 it says that they don't go to the European Union headquarters. They go to Assyria. They know who the power is. Ephraim knows where the power of Europe is, and they go to their lovers for help. What a quote from 1998. Mr. Flurry basically says, Britain understands, well, when Hosea 5:13 is fulfilled, Britain will understand that the EU isn't really the one to negotiate with, and that they need to go to Germany. We see the essence of that quote happening right now. Before I conclude, I just want to... there's so much more in the book of Hosea. I've just been going through and studying this book over the past few days, and it's really pretty incredible how much is in this book. But I've got five forecasts for the future that we can expect here in Britain. And these forecasts are based on prophecies in the book of Hosea, which Mr. Flurry writes about, which we've been writing about for many, many years. So the first one is, first, Britain's moral decline, the corruption, the immorality, the lawless behavior is going to continue, and it's going to intensify. And society is going to fragment and dissolve as a result. Something else to look for is Britain's behavior, both domestically and on the world scene, is going to look ever more foolish and naive and weak. something else to look for is that the strangers or the foreigners inside Britain are going to become a much larger force for instability and tension and conflict. Right now, you know, Britain socially is relatively stable. But there are so many foreigners here, so many different cultures, so many different religions, so many different ideologies, that there is massive potential for really intense tension and conflict. And we're going to see more conflict between the strangers or from the strangers. Another event to look for or trend is Britain increasingly looking to Germany for support and assistance. That's what it says in Hosea 5:13, but there's two or three other scriptures that talk about Ephraim going to King Jareb. I don't know if that's a specific, you know, individual on the world scene now, or if it's just a, you know, in a larger sense, Germany's leader. But Britain is going to increasingly look to Germany for support and assistance. Just because Britain is leaving the EU, don't expect to see, you know, Britain kind of fleeing from Europe. What's probably going to happen in an effort to calm the fears of Remainers, Britain may run full steam ahead at Germany and Europe. And then something else to expect is that Britain, in general, is not going to recognize the dangerous conditions that surround them. And they're not going to reach out to God for assistance. At least not until the very last second, when the nation, sadly, as the Bible prophecy says, is on the brink of extinction. Something else to expect, it's in Hosea 3, verse 4. It says, "For the children of Israel shall abide many days without a king, and without a prince, and without a sacrifice, and without an image, and without an ephod." And Mr. Flurry has explained what this verse means. But it's referring to the coming tribulation, when Britain will lose the stone of destiny, Jacob's pillar stone, when Britain will lose its monarchy. Just a quote here from page 16 of Mr. Flurry's book. "After the children of Israel lose their king, royal family, religion, and stone, they are going to seek God and King David." So the end really is positive. This all ends with Ephraim repenting. It all ends with Israel repenting. It all ends with the return of Jesus Christ. But there are going to be some sobering times between now and that end. So let's be, if we believe the Bible is God's word, then we've got so much to be thankful for. Thank God for Hosea. Thank God for these prophecies. And really, you know, take your watching of these prophecies beyond just being excited about prophetic fulfillment. But get excited about the fact that Brexit and Britain moving toward Germany. Thank God that these prophecies prove God's existence. Let the fulfillment of these prophecies build your faith in God's church, in the Bible, in God's government, and who his end time apostle is. These prophecies and the prophetic fulfillment that we're witnessing really ought to be producing a lot of spiritual growth in God's people. Awesome, awesome things are happening in this world, and the hope, you know, God hopes that awesome things will also happen in our lives as a result of what's happening in this world and all of the prophecy that we see being fulfilled. Well, I didn't get to half the material that I had brought today, but I guess I can save it for another day. Thanks for having me, and I'll be with you when I be with you. Who knows when that will be.